If there's content that's borderline, that's content that we basically will not.
There is no second best. There is no second best crypto asset.
I respect you, and I have a great deal of appreciation to you, Jaya.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to JFG tonight for the celebration of the 7 years of the revolutionary phenotype. Eric has sent a massive super chat.
I was watching Brett Weinstein last show. It was about evolution, fossil records, and intelligent design, instead of the revolutionary phenotype. What year is this?
Thank you so much for the donation, and bro, Brett Weinstein, like, I want to try respecting him sometimes. But then I'm reminded of how retarded he is. Like, seriously, Brett, you are 10 years late on most stuff. You're doing atheist coverage like we did in 2013. Today, he made a tweet about, you know, women of Western civilization are broken. It's no, you don't say. Like, who the fuck is determining the agenda of Brett Weinstein? Is he getting PowerPoint presentations from gatekeeping institutional jury or whatever? They're trying to occupy more and more space that they had totally abandoned and ignored for a decade. Like, recently he's been starting suddenly to talk about America first, and here's what America first should be. Bro, this is 2025. This is 2025. You're 10 years late to the discussion. Thank you for lighting up, but it's like how does this not happen before? John Drake says, always late to the party. Yeah, it's amazing. Now, today we'll talk about the revolutionary phenotype. It's repetitive a little bit because every year what I do is I revisit the concepts of the revolutionary phenotype, because as long as people haven't accepted this theory, it's what I have to do. And I've decided to sacrifice my life to advancing this theory. And people aren't serious enough about it. Beat Soup says, how interesting is it that Mama JF met her end not with the homeless junkies in Europe jumping trains, but with a PhD who's never done drugs. But she didn't meet her hand with me. She probably met her hand with homeless junkies, the homeless junkies of Canada. Dead Star says, Styx is defending JF's character on his show. He was unaware of the Mama JF situation. He said he'd like to speak with you sometimes. Styx, unfortunately, is in a huge mess with the courts now, as his ex convinced them to bring really harsh charges against him. Bro, I've seen some of that mess. I've seen his arrest. I totally stand with Styx. I am absolutely convinced that this is an operation of vengeance, if not an intelligence operation. Certainly an operation of vengeance by a crazy woman. People don't know what it is to fuck crazy. Like, you guys don't know what we're dealing with here. But I know, and Styx knows, and it's extremely clear that this is what happened. I always took by Styx on this story from months ago when this whole thing arose. And I'm happy to hear that he's defending my character. And absolutely, I would love to speak with him any occasion. He can just send me a DM and I'll say yes. And today, just a couple of news before we get into the revolutionary phenotype. Stephen Robinson says, I was once a homeless Canadian train hopper, never saw Mama JF on the streets. Canada is a wide place, so you can be on the streets and not see someone else. Sonic Crockett says, I have indeed slept with crazy. I ended up homeless with domestic violence allegations. Bro, women are absolutely untrustable. We need to find a way to tighten the system so that basically when you accept to be in a relationship, there shouldn't be any possibility for the police to get involved unless there's injuries, physical injuries, indicative of a crime. This should be the standard. But we're very far from this, in fact. But it depends where you live. You know, in Alberta, I have found peace. And my ex tried messing with me, and holy shit, did she fail. She didn't even get a visit to me. She didn't even get a visit from the government saying, JF, we're just trying to look if everything is okay. No, you don't get this in an area that has kept sense in the way it manages its government and that understands that, yes, there's a vengeful woman are a force of lies and misdirections. Beat Soup says, it was Stick's crazy ex he is still in love with. She used him to pay her rent this month, and this was how she repaid him. Oh yeah, Stix probably has enough money that it doesn't matter, but don't give a dollar to these women. Don't give a dollar. They will always pay back in evil. So that's the only way in which a woman pays back her debt. It's in evil. It's in vengefulness. So you might as well stay neutral, keep them poor. And the poorer they are, the less power they have and the less likely they are to make bad decisions for themselves even. Stephen Robinson says, Jeff, when Alberta referendum? Oh, well, there's people who make efforts for this in the province. I've not been following super closely, but there are encouraging signs that perhaps something like a referendum will happen. I'm happy about it. I think it will be kind of a consultatory referendum to begin with, but it's a good start. It's a good start. Give me 1 second. All right, so what did we have on Candace's show tonight? She invited the guy who... It's still unclear whether this guy has fell onto anything important. He says he was in Arizona one day before the Charlie Kirk assassination, and he fell onto a secret meeting of the army. And they gave him a lot of trouble for having just randomly happened to fall there. And they kind of tried pushing him into, why are you here? Are you a spy? Are you trying to get information? Who sent you here? So he felt like he had fallen onto a very secretive meeting by accident. And the big revelation today that he's doing live as he is interviewed by Candace. He says, I'm 95% sure that I saw in those meeting places on that day, the day before Charlie Kirk died, that I saw Brian Harpole and that I saw Erica Kirk. So that is the novel claim today, that Erica Kirk would have been at a secret army meeting in Arizona. And he's 95% sure, 95%. That he recognized her. As Candace has already pointed out, there can be doppelgangers, there can be errors, and it can also be that Erica Kirk was actually there, but that it was for not any nefarious purpose. But it's an interesting data point that's emerging today. What do we do with this? Nothing allows us to conclude anything at this point, because what if it's a doppelganger? What if this guy is just, maybe he's delusional? Who knows? I mean, some people can be delusional and you wouldn't tell on your first conversation with them, you know? But he seems to be reliable. He doesn't seem to be giving any indication of psychosis or whatever. But someone can be easily led down false memories and mistaken remembrance. That being said, it's interesting. What I would like is to know from the side of Erica Kirk, is that true? Were you in an army meeting one day before your husband died? Interesting line of questioning. Again, we're in the epistemology of Candace Owens. It's an epistemology of questions and of investigation. But I'd rather have the question than nothing. The question is better than nothing. Beat Soup says, JF, how's the insemination going? I shall not comment on this at this moment. What else do we have in the news? Yeah, Brylan Ollihand continues with the streak of boomer tweets. This guy is unbelievable. He says, if you take your kids to the mall to visit Santa, maybe you should think about taking your kids to church to meet Jesus. Like, reading this guy's tweet, it's amazing. I understand what he's trying to say. He's trying to say, you know, give priority to Christian education of your children rather than commercial Santa version of Christmas. But every time he writes something, this guy sounds like a 60-year-old. I don't know how you get that. I don't know how you get that physically. Like, how do you raise a child so protected from current culture that he actually sounds like a 60-year-old whenever he expresses himself? Sonny Crockett says, a gentleman doesn't inseminate and tell. Exactly. Policy of secrecy. Ty Rogerson says, my uncle is like that. He was an old man at 14. All right. So today is windy and very cold in Alberta. It's been windy yesterday too, very strong winds. And I love this feeling of the winter. We've been staying inside, warm, heated by natural gas. It's a pleasure to be in such a harsh winter, absolutely beautiful place. The plains are leaving place to the strongest winds possible. Nothing can stop wind in Alberta, and it's a beautiful view to see the snow. Now, the wind was so strong, it destroyed my trash box. So I brought my trash bag inside. Maybe there will be ways to repair it. But for now, I have lost that little box. Beet Soup says, maybe raised by grandparents. Yeah, it may happen, especially in a family, if the parents are in business or whatever, and they're very busy, but they're kind of from a wealthy family, and the grandparents have a lot of time. Sometimes you get a Brylan Ollihand. Kid's Dad says, clam chowder must be in white people food for cold days like this. Clam chowder already has its page in white people food. I've been writing a page about what is white people food. Here, let me read from it. Because there's the question of people are going to say, I have a black friend who ate Swedish meatballs. How is that white people food? And so I wrote, what is white people food? It's a number of different things. I can already sense the critiques coming in. How are these foods white people foods? What do you mean by white people food? What about my African friend who ate Swedish meatballs at IKEA? I think for the most part, a strict definition is unnecessary. I'd rather we approach this question with a plethora of various definitions and say, if it can check a few of these boxes, then it's white people food. One, it's food that has been invented by people of European descent. Two, it's food that is part of the historical traditions of European descent majority countries. Three, it's food that is currently eaten in white countries. Four, it's food that was made possible by the developed chains of supply of a European descent civilization. Five, it's food that white people like to eat, or that their ancestors like to eat. 6. It's any food that if you were to turn your head up as you taste it, you would expect to see mostly white people around. 7. It's food that has been inspired by other cultures but integrated into the living practices of white people. 8. It's food that if white people were completely removed from an area, the food would sooner or later disappear from the traditions of this area. 9. It's food that relied at some point in the past on white farmers, producers, distributors, or chefs. 10. It's food that reproduces or seeks to put forward traditional techniques and ingredients that stemmed from white civilizational history. 11. It's food that relies on ingredients coming from lands that have been traditionally lived on by white people. And 12, it's food that is tied to the history of European Christianity or consumed in collective meals between people of European Christian descent. And I wrote, food disappears, and then people do. In general, my goal in writing the recipes for this book was to capture the most elementary form of a recipe. Those are not by any means the best recipes or the most complex ones for any given meal. My goal was rather to capture a dish in its simplest form. You should consider those recipes as bases for your culinary explorations rather than finalized, optimized forms. The reason for this approach is that I believe much of white people food is at risk of disappearing and needs to be captured in books for posterity. It takes more than a few white people to preserve our food culture in any given place. It takes bread makers, producers, chefs, clientele that is interested in those foods. A non-white buys a slaughterhouse and suddenly it stops producing blood sausages due to religious preferences. A small proportion of white hipster families move out of town and suddenly the local burger place doesn't have enough customers to keep going. A charcutier goes into retirement and his products get replaced by pink slime bologna. White people food is fragile. It doesn't take a whole country emptying itself of white people to lose its European food culture. I have seen white people food disappear from areas before white people were even out. As such, I like to see food as the canary in the coal mine for civilizational decline. Food falls before your people does. The flip side of this is that every time you prepare white people food, you are committing an act of resistance against the disappearance of our peoples and our ways of life across the world. So that is my comment on white people food. There will always be people coming into the chat uninformed and, did we hear about Mama JF? What is happening? Why aren't you guys asking questions? It's like, bro, do I have to speak of this every fucking day? It's like, there will always be one more of you that just doesn't follow, that just doesn't know the current state of things. Cat's Dead says, that's deep. Thank you very much. Sadie Edward says, pink slime bologna, savage. There are some parts of this book that are pretty savage. I go hard. I think one of the reactions people will have to this book is they're gonna say, "Holy shit! I didn't expect that food mattered that much." Like, I'm not kidding. This is an important book, and it's I can't say it in any other words. It's a major book, and yet it's a cookbook. That's how it is. That's I don't make the rules. I'm just the messenger. Dead Star says some of it can definitely be left to the history books. Please leave the groundhog recipes out. I'm pretty sure folks ate that on the frontier. Groundhog. I didn't have any plan to put groundhog recipes, nor do I have any plan to put what they call roadkill cuisine. There's these guys who are like, you know, they eat squirrel and they look like squirrels for some reason. It's like they eat rats that they bumped onto with their car, and they end up looking like rats. You are what you eat. You are what you eat. And these people, somehow they eat squirrels and they end up having the teeth of squirrels. It's not my intent to include this in white people food because I don't consider it an important phenomenon of white cuisine. And yeah, I know it exists. I've seen there was an episode of Gordon Ramsay where some guy was like a fan of roadkill cuisine. All right. So let's talk about the revolutionary funeral. Oh yeah, and DF has asked, are all the Italian foods white people food? I kind of waver on this. I thought I had disabled this alarm, but some special types of super chat apparently haven't been disabled yet. I've been actually juggling with the idea of whether Italian food is white people food, whether pizza, pasta belong in there. It's kind of my limit. I've kind of decided that Greek food, modern Greek food, is not white people food. I've also introduced one recipe of a Greek soup because it was traditional enough and it seems to be pushed by white Greeks. As far as Italians go, I will probably insert a recipe for pasta and a recipe for pizza, but that's it. And I will also talk of the cheese culture of Italy. But I'm not sure. So I think that there's plenty of Italian cookbooks out there and it's kind of over. I'm kind of tired of it. I'm tired of every cookbook having so many pasta recipes. It's like very lazy cuisine. Now, I know that there is a strong food culture of Italy, and I want it just partly represented in my book, just to make a nod to it. But I don't know that Italy is a white country for a long time still. GM for the People says, Greek food after the fall of Constantinople, sorry. I mean, it's like, when you start asking these questions, what is the extent of the spread of the white food phenomenon? And it's very clear when you enter in Greece, Turkey, it's not that I can't find someone in Greece right now that would look white to you. You would. You can pick a person that doesn't have much of a tan and you're going to say, well, what's the difference between this person and a white European? But then you start looking at the food culture and it's like baklava and it's like gyros and Now, Gyros, it's like it starts in Greece and then it goes down to North Africa. Now, so is Gyros white people food because it attained in its northern spread a degree of a kind of partly white country? I like to look at the recipe and say, what is the geographic spread of this? And if it's 75% non-white countries, and then 25%, it kind of makes it into the north. That's not white people food to me. And you can write your other book about white people food and say, no, I'm going to write a book in which Greeks are white. Okay, go ahead and write. Good luck. But it's like, it's just not my vision. It's in my view, when I see the recipes that I include in this book, I see so many parallels between a Quebecois recipe and a Swedish recipe. And then I don't find a trace of this meal in North Africa. And you can't get this meal in Tunisia. Now, that to me sounds more like European-centric food. When there's an overlap and it's mostly in the Middle East and mostly in North Africa, but then it kind of makes it into Mediterranean culture, not very white food to me. Chad Bergson has sent a super chat. Thank you so much for the support. He says, I can't believe I've had my copy for 7 years and been listening to JF for about 10. Wow, wow, wow. What an honor. It's been a long road for the revolutionary phenotype, and we're not even done. I don't even know that we're halfway through the final success of this book. So, the revolutionary phenotype right here, published in 2018 after, I would say, 3 years of intense work on it. I had left academia in 2015, and I was working on this idea. At first, it was just themes that I was juggling with in my mind. And ultimately, it came to express a theory of the emergence of genetic layers. And it's a correct theory. It has not been debunked properly. You'll find a couple of blog posts by haters out there. But they're like, oh, I don't like the style, and oh, he uses these words, and oh, he doesn't have the influence in the scientific field. Oh, he doesn't have a Q, a quotation index factor. That is absolute bullshit. A theory is insightful or it's not insightful. It's true or it's not true. My theory seeked at first to resolve some of the contradictions that I was perceiving in memetics, the idea of memes, and the fact that memes had not really been integrated to biology in a way that made sense. memes had been defectively introduced in biology, and no one really knew exactly why it was wrong, but almost everyone felt it was wrong. And Richard Dawkins made his best in The Selfish Gene to kind of self-check the idea. He put the idea out there, but he also questioned it. Here's another one that's in need of a ban. Let's ban this guy. So yeah, it's like memes, are they reproducing? And if they're not, in what sense? Because it seems that a priori, if you don't know much about it, it seems that memes are a good idea. And it seems that life forms appear like they should be neutral to each other. So if you have something that makes copies in a brain, how is it different from an eagle flying in the sky and a mouse walking on the ground? There's two replicators. The eagle wants to make babies. The mouse wants to make babies. And it seems we have an ecological system here. And everyone felt that memes somehow it doesn't work. And it, memes have led the thinkers across the 80s, 90s, and 2000, from Richard Dawkins to Daniel Dennett and Susan Blackmore. It has misled thinkers into making false predictions about human culture. Like Richard Dawkins, for example, had the belief that certain human cultural memes are parasitic, that they reproduce to their own interest. In a way, an eagle would reproduce against the population of mouse. That is, the eagles are living off parasitically from the energy produced by the mouse. So that's a parasitic or symbiotic relationship, parasitic and symbiosis being a continuum. I've made the case for this before. But Richard Dawkins had basically the idea that memes can be predatory. Just like the eagle is predatory to the mouse, there can be bad ideas. And the bad ideas, they come attached together and they kind of bind you toward acting against your interest. And Richard Dawkins had to kind of modify his morality and adopt a certain moral angle for this to make sense. So he ended up constructing the idea that religion is a parasite, that religion is a predator. But the logical jump that he did there to convince himself that some ideas were parasitic, he forgot to check the reproductive rates. Because by the standard of reproductive rates, religion is absolutely not a parasitic bad idea. It's a good idea. It's a good idea for selection. It's a good idea for people's survival. And it does protect even immigrant communities in Western nations. It partly protects them from the anti-natalist propaganda of the modern state. So it's like when you see Muslim social conservative families in Canada, they are not affected by the same level of propaganda that atheist families are. And strongly Christian families have the same level of social conservativeness and protection against the truly bad memes, which is the liberal anti-natalist LGBT ideology memes. But all of this didn't come clear to Richard Dawkins. He couldn't see that it's his ideology that's a parasite, and it's a fading parasite. It's a parasite that's going to go away, the same way he describes it in the extended phenotype. But because Richard Dawkins was such a liberal on a moral quest, he couldn't see that the ideas that he criticizes are actually reproductively protective. That Christianity, Islam, and Judaism are actually systems of dating that are extremely efficient and that protect families from bad influences from the outside. Marby Dog says religion can also have beneficial psychological effects. Yes, but we'll leave this on the side because psychological theory are not ultimate. I was truly interested in the ultimate question of embedded replicator systems. So an embedded replicator system are two replicators. They exist in the same environment and they're making babies. And the babies of the babies of the babies are all interacting with one another. The way a farmer's baby is interacting with the cow's babies. The cow's babies are interacting with the later generations of the farmer's babies. Those are embedded replicator systems. And in the normal ecology, they do not do anything special. They follow the rules of the selfish gene. It's just that there's two selfish genes. The cow is selfish, she wants to reproduce. And the farmer gives her that because the farmer helps her spread across the world. The farmer on his side wants to reproduce too. And the cow helps him reproduce because he can sell the dead bodies of the cows. So it's a symbiotic relationship that develops there. And the question is, Can a single organism host many replicators? And replicators who have an existential conflict between them. Because the idea that Richard Dawkins had already been investigating this, the idea that an organism can carry many replicators, no doubt it can. It's actually every letter of DNA that you have is an independent replicator. And that's why Richard Dawkins chose the gene-centric view. It's because one of your genes is potentially at war or at odds with some other of your genes. So if you have a gene that wants to give you openness of mind, and then you have a gene that wants to give you conservatism, there's going to be conflicts between the two. Ultimately, your babies will have one or two of the genes, or just one of them, but not the other. And ultimately, selection will do its work. If being open-minded is too punitive, your babies that have the open-minded genes will die. If being conservative is rewarding, your babies that have the conservative gene will survive better and make more babies. So the idea of multiple replicators exists. The idea even of existential conflicts between multiple replicators within a single organism also exists. Robert Rivers, in the Selfish Genetic Elements book, describes the idea of kamikaze sperm genes. So it's partly a theoretical idea, but we think that perhaps we've seen that in some, I believe, in some rat population, where what if you had a gene that detects if the other sperms contain that gene and it kills them? Like, these genes are in one sperm cell, but they eliminate the other sperm cells that don't have this flag on them that says, I have this gene. That would be what we call a selfish genetic element. It's a gene that's trying to reproduce more than 50%. It's trying to kill the other genes in the organism and only lead to that line to survive. Now, those genes are said to be, and this is all described by Robert Rivers and his co-author, those genes are thought to be overly selfish and destructive. They kind of deprive you of the advantage of sexual reproduction, which is reassortment and randomness. But the idea is out there that there could be existential conflicts between single genes in an organism. And that's where I was standing when I started writing The Revolutionary Phenotype. Now, I asked an even more radical idea. Can a gene be in the phenotype? Can a gene be produced by a gene? And that is the embedded question, the kind of Russian doll rabbit hole that I decided to follow, which unlocked so much information and unlock the whole theory of descent, of common descent of the viruses, which didn't exist before, didn't exist in full. At least there were theories and there were guesses being made, but it didn't exist in the form that I presented, which is I know the exact set of branches that link all families of viruses. And I know what happened 4 billion years ago, thanks to this interrogation. So then we enter into the theoretical consequences of accepting this idea. So first and foremost, what is an instance of this having happened? A phenotype that is a gene. Because you have your genes, which in our organisms is DNA. And then you have the phenotype, which is the rest of your body and everything in your cells. It's literally 99.999% of your mass. That is your phenotype. And it's like, what if the phenotype becomes a gene and how can it become a gene? Well, there were early thoughts about this and the idea that somehow, if DNA didn't exist at some point and started existing then at some other point, then it must have been a phenotype for a second at least. And the ideas were out there, and the idea of transition from RNA to DNA was, of course, out there very strongly, because it became the whole RNA world hypothesis. But I was like, well, that causes problems, right? Because in the same way I see problems with Richard Dawkins' concept of mimetics, which is, no, you shouldn't be hosting parasitical IDs. You shouldn't be hosting IDs in your brain that kill you. If that happens, you are subject to selection just like any other things you would hold in your brain. Doesn't matter that the ID comes from outside or inside of you. The rules of evolution must apply. Therefore, the bad memes must die. Therefore, religion must always be pro-reproduction. Because the religions that aren't pro-reproduction, they disappear quick. So I knew that Richard Dawkins was wrong in mimetics, or at least his followers were wrong in pushing a whole true mimetics as a true life form view. But I also knew that thinking had been done, that there was a moment on planet Earth where there wasn't DNA. Therefore, there was a moment at which the RNA life form must have created DNA in some form. And I was like, this also doesn't work. Because if you create DNA, you have no genetic interest in maintaining it because it's not a copy of you. Therefore, the minute a replicator like DNA is introduced in the environment, it's a competitor. It's an eagle. It's a bad meme. It's a bad ID. So see from my thinking around ecological systems with eagles and mice, mimetic systems with human culture and the human genes, and then DNA, I said, the whole thing doesn't work. It's not consistent. There has to be a special allowance for DNA to have been able to survive. And it cannot have been produced instantly and suddenly worked. Because with biology, the problem is you need time. You need years and years and millions of years of evolution for something intelligent and structured to develop. There had to be a response as to how DNA did that. Why did DNA succeed at becoming a life form? And why did human culture not succeed? So that was the line of thought that led to the theory of phenotypic revolutions. And it goes as follows. Because Richard Dawkins had already initiated that thinking in finding two problems that had to be resolved for a phenotypic revolution to occur. First, the first problem is that DNA, when it showed up, there's big chances that the first molecule of DNA was produced erroneously and may not have been capable of copying itself. And that is the Occam's razor here. It is much more likely that it was incapable of replicating itself and already was a life form than it was not. So it is an economy of thought to be saying DNA at first was an accident and it was kind of an handicapped molecule that wasn't capable of doing much. Now I have to justify why would it acquire replication? And there may be various ideas. I present them in my book. The particular idea or the particular path doesn't matter. What matters is a new replicator that can become potentially a replicator. It first faces hurdles. The first hurdle is it's not reproductive. The second hurdle is it exists in a new environment that is not habituated to having this molecule. And the third hurdle is that even if it was to start making copies, it would be subject to control and manipulation by the life form that created it. So we know that DNA is close enough to RNA that whenever that accident happened, it must have been because the replicas that was in charge of making RNA copies had a misalignment on the other end. Where on one end it was reading RNA, and on the other end it was habitually rewriting another RNA copy. But that side that was handling the RNA copy maybe had a little defect in it, or maybe some molecules around there pushed inside in, instead of RNA molecules there, started pushing molecules of DNA, which is just slightly different in that it has a deoxy part on the molecule. So DNA is not super different from RNA. But at some point, a molecule had a bug that was leading it to dump its information rather than in RNA, started dumping it into DNA. Now, these three problems that I listed are the three problems of the phenotype, and they are also indicative of why there is always a particular solution to phenotypic revolutions. That particular solution is the replicator tango. So we kind of had some theories that were inclusive of a replicator tango, but it was never named this before my book. And we had never generalized the concept. We knew that RNA at some point was interacting with DNA because we have modern viruses in which it's happening. The information goes from RNA to DNA, DNA to RNA, RNA to DNA, DNA to RNA. So we know that there's a primitive state in which the interaction between the two molecules is an exchange. But then I realized something thinking about the three problems. I realized that this very thing, this bilateral exchange between two molecules, is actually necessary for a phenotypic revolution. The reason it's necessary is that as long as it doesn't happen, there is no way for the novel life form, for the revolutionary phenotype, to reach a level of independence and control over the ancient life form so that their interests are melded together evolutionarily. So when you think about the three problems that I listed, the molecule isn't copying. The molecule is isolated in a novel environment. And the molecule is controlled by the ancient life form. When a replicator tango establishes, it's when the novel molecule comes in, starts determining the genes of the babies of the ancient life form. So what you had is RNA was making its babies first. It eventually discovered that it can pass through an intermediary form in DNA. And it realized that DNA was so superior that the best way for RNA to make babies was to trust DNA. Trust it as a hard drive. It's a better hard drive. It's a better machine. It does better than you. Now, what if I told you as a human, I have found a technology that can make much more of your babies, and you won't even have to injure a woman. I can, for the small sum of $10,000, I can produce 1,000 of your babies. They will be genetically yours. We can even combine them with fictive woman, and we will grow them in artificial embryos. And they will actually be more healthy than the babies you could have done. Because the babies you could have done, they'd be subject to all sorts of defects like trisomy, chromosomal disorders due to the lack of quality in the egg. And you're going to have to endure the pain of interacting with a woman for 20 years while raising this child. The alternative, I can produce infinite babies for you. They are on average more healthy, and they are on average even, because we do the processing of DNA copy in the lab, will even be more accurate than nature would have been in your own sperm. that offer that I did right there to you as a human is the offer that RNA was presented. Either I continue copying myself with rates of errors and I'm losing information every generation and my molecules aren't solid and they aren't very resistant to temperature change and etc. Or I can dump myself into DNA. I can stay there for much longer where I would have had a mutation within an hour in the RNA. I'm going to have 1 year without a mutation on the DNA. And this molecule, I can then use it as an archived copy of myself to produce my future babies. It's a little bit how people will freeze their sperm and eggs. But it's but unlike the sperm and eggs, because the frozen sperm and eggs, they're low quality and you have less chances of winning with them. RNA had more chances to win with DNA. And it had discovered a way to improve its own genetic storage. Now, there is a massive problem that arises in those specific circumstances. When you are using another genetic storage, you are not you anymore. The genetic storage is as much you as you are. Like, what's the difference between the DNA that you actually hold in your balls and the theoretical DNA that I could get on your 23andMe account? It's the same. You potentially, if your 23andMe account had at its disposal ways to write DNA into sequences and to produce artificial babies, then you might as well say that you are your 23andMe account more than you are your own testicles. Because your 23andMe account could potentially create more babies for you than you can. That is the big realization of the theory of phenotypic revolution, which is once you are split between two media, the evolutionary situation is radically different. Now, suddenly, you are not even a competitor with that 23andMe account. You are just like twins. You're like a split organism where it's not even clear that you are the best expression of yourself. I could maybe produce perfect copies of JF straight from my 23andMe account. I could produce 50 of them, and maybe one of them would be more successful than me. And that is how RNA saw life when it had created its DNA queen. That is how it happened. Now, what are the conditions for a replicator tango to happen? Well, you need to have a molecule dump itself, a genetic molecule dump itself into a new media. It does so at first because the new media is better. It's an evolutionary step. It's naturally selected. But once this cycle has occurred where your 23andMe account is making more babies than you are, then the 23andMe account takes over as a life form. And then it's a matter of, is real JF capable of even competing with his 23andMe account? You know, you could imagine a future of social genetics in which literally I would have a picture of me on my 23andMe account, and I would be selling the idea that you should take those genes to have your baby. And perhaps there would be a woman in Australia who falls in love with my account, who says, wow, this guy has good stats. 5'6" is what I love. What a Chad. What an intellectual Chad. I want those 23andMe genes to be injected in my future baby. You can have a whole shopping experience stemming from a phenotypic revolution. And I believe that something like that must have happened because I believe that the state of the biological cell 4 billion years ago, before it had DNA, I believe it was communities of anarchically organized RNA. Because RNA cannot have a whole big genome. It it's clear that functionality in those organisms probably relied a lot on outside invaders. Viral forms of RNA joining in the community that a cell was. But eventually, with the phenotypic revolution, what you have is that communities are transformed into single beings. And that is so important to human societies right now. This general principle of phenotypic revolution is going to wreck human civilization, and I'll come back to it later. But think about it. RNA segments were unstable and they couldn't be long. So a cell was always limited. It couldn't acquire a whole genome that would be attached to itself, that would be a long chain, like our modern genomes. So back then, and we know that it still exists, so we know it must have been happening back then, there were genes in the form of RNA that were jumping from cells to cell. And it wasn't like a cell is an individual. It was more like a cell is a community. And it's integrating jumping viruses that are released as plasmids, which we know still happens today. But eventually, the DNA genome came to organize all of this. And the DNA genome abolished this lifestyle that communities of RNA molecules had. The DNA genome was more fit to survive over long periods of time. The DNA genome could still benefit from plasmid-introduced RNAs. And the DNA genome was more accurate in its copy. So it had all of the advantages such that those bacteria-like cells that chose the path of staying a long time in DNA eventually outcompeted the cells that were spending half and half, or the cells that were spending most of their time in RNA form. It's a simple natural selection equation happening at this point. Because at this point, the RNA is not truly fighting against DNA. DNA and RNA exchanging their genetic information from one side to the other, and then inversely, are both tied to each other's reproductive success. So it's a little bit like the farmer and the cow, where the cow wants to be farmed and the farmer wants to farm the cow. They both benefit. Well, in a replicator tango, the two genetic medium benefit. And that's why it passes the three problems. Now let's drive back a little bit. And why are memes not like replicator tangos? Well, the reason is memes don't yet write their information in our genetic code. So memes aren't advantage. We aren't tied to memes in a existential fatalistic bond, which DNA and RNA were. DNA was writing its information in RNA. RNA was writing its information in DNA. The information was either surviving or not surviving, but it was the two molecules are either surviving or they're both dead. Memes aren't like that yet. Because there aren't clubs of social relationships in which people discuss how they're going to introduce new ideas into the human genome. Quite simply, there's no Facebook group in which people say, hey, I'm gonna OMG myself. I'm gonna GMO myself next week. I'm going to see my doctor. I'm gonna get this gene and that gene. And I want to get them in my eggs and my balls too. That doesn't happen yet. And because of this, memes are kept in check by human evolution. This is why all religions converge toward telling people to make babies. This is why Richard Dawkins was wrong. Religions aren't parasitic. They are helpful. They are sculpted products of natural selection. Now, it wouldn't take much for current human culture to be a replicator tango. All that it would take is that doctors allow some degree of genetic modification of human babies. And inevitably, just allowing this will inevitably build a user base that would inevitably pursue various decisions about what they change in their babies. And people keep saying, oh, they would choose people with blue eyes and blonde hair. That's the least of your worries, bro. That's the least of your worries. Because they would change human psychology. They would conform. In the way people's behavior conform when you look through the COVID crisis. So genetic choices will systematically be like women. Conformist, shaping, sculpting, and control. How women think very much will eventually translate once we are able to do this on a regular basis, will eventually transfer into the choices that we make into genetic matters for our babies. Now, this little change to human culture seems like it's going to come. In The Revolutionary Phenotype, I describe AI roomfuls of servers computing everything about human culture, knowing everything, every magazine, every piece of Wikipedia. Are we there yet? We are exactly there. We are exactly in what I describe. I described this 7 years ago. And we already have the AI roomfuls of servers. And they are already getting interested in the equation between genetics and phenotype. Because that equation, the equation that tells you you have this gene, therefore you'll be a basketball player, or you have this gene and you might get a Nobel Prize, that equation will be very easy to figure out for the AIs we've built. Arguably, actually, the AIs have already accomplished harder. It's harder to understand every aspect of human culture and be able to drop a recipe of Collins kink soup on demand than it is to know statistically, you know, this gene is pretty good, this gene is pretty bad. That will be easy for AI. Ty Rogerson says, well, the longer it takes, JF, the more prescient you were. yes. Yes. I guess I have the choice as an author. Do I want to be right in a million years from now, or do I want to be right in 30 years from now? Hopefully it's a million years. Because hopefully it gets us some time to react. But yeah, we are about to enter a replicator tango. This is extremely important. It's extremely important because we are about to centralize communal processes of a free nature, and we're about to enslave them to a process of chosen direction. Now, chosen direction is not a good way to evolve. It's not in our interest, and it is impossible that human psychology is well fit to make decisions about our handling of the future ecological state of the world. It's impossible. It's almost certain that people's choice will be maladaptive. It's almost certain that people's choice will be abandoning aspects of human cognition that we shouldn't want to abandon. Dead Star says, if you haven't read TRP in 7 years, please leave the chat. Yeah, get the fuck out. This is for the real ones. No, it's fine if you haven't read it, but do go buy your copy and now do it, because human choice cannot guide evolution. Like, imagine I was to present you with a godlike position, that I'm putting you in the position of God and you are put 7 million years ago, and you have chimpanzees and macaques and gorillas and orangutans, there's no way you could have thought we need humans. Unless you were a human and you were looking at yourself and you thought, oh, let's make more of me. But if you weren't a human, there's no way you would have invented humans. There's no way you would have come close to something like this. There's no way you could have invented comedy if it hadn't existed before, if it hadn't arisen naturally. There's no way you would have invented creativity. There's no way you would have invented from absolute scratch a mathematical thinking ape. Why? Why not a mathematical thinking nut? Why not a philosophizing salamander? No. You wouldn't have had the idea of inventing humans from chimpanzees. And for the same reason that you wouldn't have had this idea, you are incapable of making the decisions for our future in 7 million years from now. And yet that's the key we're about to give to literally retarded people. We're about to give this retarded species of ape the key to its own future. And they're going to mess with it. They're going to make a mess out of it. We are not worthy of this system of decision. We will farm ourselves into absolute crap within a few thousand years from having this technology. Just look at how we handled the COVID stuff if you want to know how it will go. We're going to be conformist. We're going to be extortionist. We're going to be socially pressured. We're going to create bad economic incentives. And really, you wouldn't even need genetic modification to realize how bad people are at making evolutionary decisions. Just look at how governments are managing our evolutionary direction, favoring the poor, favoring the incapable, funding the infinite production of babies from people who are not self-sustaining. We've already by far started our descent into the abyss. We've done this only with good intentions. We've done this solely with good intentions. Only by wanting to help people, only by wanting to cure people, we made them worse. And the IQ curve has started descending, and it's not looking like there's going to be a bottom to it. So once we start helping people even further with genes, we're going to disrupt the human evolutionary direction even further. And down the line, this is the last part I have to say about the revolutionary phenotype today. I took the experiment to its end. What does it look like at the end? Well, at the end, you have a central entity that is providing recipes of genetic modification for everyone. And everyone has fought for their right to get those genetic modification, just like they fought to get a booster of the vaccine. And what it looks like is clans of communities that are all operated and genetically directed by single corporate entities that spawned off of the medical clinics that offer genetic modifications or hospitals. And these clinics or hospitals, they become eventually centers of genetic attraction. And they have their own recipes. And you can go to one or you can go to another. This one will give you certain gene recommendations that this other one will not give you. And you can shop and you can get better or worse. But down the line, you get worse because the competition between these various genetic clubs that humanity is about to ensconce itself in, the competition leads to an evolution above us. Right now, we are evolving for the best of ourselves. You are evolving to make the best babies you can, and the babies you produce, they are evolving to make the best babies they can. Once societies are taken over by centrally controlled genetic modification, the evolutionary interests are not in the improving the people anymore. They are in improving the central entity. And a central entity's success is not measured in the quality of human beings that it produces. It's not measured in their freedom or even in their capacity to reproduce outside of the clinic. It's selected for sterile worker humans that will enhance the success of the central unit. And that may mean classes of reduced humans that have zero creativity, that are machines. It can lead to unreproductive humans. Probably most humans will become incapable of reproducing under this regime. And it can mean the absolute reduction of everything that makes us want to pursue originality and uniqueness in a free dating market. Because being funny, being a social leader, being intelligent, marking history, whatever it is that your dream is, it stems in your mind because you're trying to impress girls. And once a central genetic control is imposed onto humanity, there's no reason why you want to impress girls. You'll just want to make society work so that your central AI that programmed you will be optimized in its survival and in its own reproduction. As such, we are about to become sterile worker caste for an AI central genetic control algorithm. Mark my words, it's happening. And every year that you live on this earth, and your children and your grandchildren, all that they will see for the next thousands of years is JF was right. JF was right. Holy shit, was he right. Holy shit, was he in advance. I've played the tape to its end. It's a submitted civilization that we end up with if we take the path of genetic modifications. And I implore people to take this seriously. This is graver than global climate change. There's no way global climate change kills everyone. There's always going to be little rat humans surviving somewhere underground. But there's a way a phenotypic revolution abolishes humanity. And whatever is left after this is a bunch of robots doing whatever they want to do. Sean B says, but how will we ejaculate with sex? Will the AI have to milk men of their semen? You won't even need a dick. The AI can get your genes from a spit sample. You're going to be excellent at spitting, let me tell you this. Your descendants are going to be pro-spitter. They're going to produce 10 times the saliva you have. They're going to be like, I want to make more babies for the AI. With saliva just falling. And it's going to be as pleasurable to them to salivate as it is to you to come. Those are radical predictions, but it's what the playing out of the theory shows. So it's like, yeah, I know it's bizarre, but I also know it's true. Magister Templi says, met a Peruvian baby biologist last summer, and when I said, oh, that's pretty smart business, will be good with all the sterility. And she said, no, what do you mean, lol? Sterilized by experimental vaccines. Beet Soup says we could always move to the Arctic Circle with climate change. Canada would be far richer. Exactly. There's no way any of the catastrophic scenarios, even global nuclear war, there's no way it eradicates humanity. You may have difficulty with your provisioning of foie gras for 20 years if there's a global nuclear war. But I'm telling you, some humans are surviving it. And some humans are surviving climate change no matter what. But I don't think a single human is surviving a phenotypic revolution. Not a single one. If they survive, it will be such miserable existence. We will literally be comparable to the state of HIV viruses these days, or any of the RNA viruses. We will be like literally uninvited guests of the greater mechanical organisms that are about to arise from us. All right, for Chris, for Christ says, have people tried sending a copy of TRP to Brett Weinstein? Brett Weinstein has a signed copy straight from me, because back in the days, someone sent a super chat to him and said, I would like you to comment on this book. And I offered them to send them copies. So both him and Heather have a signed copy with a personal letter from me. Written in the opening page. Despite this, unfortunately, Brett has decided to ignore the theory and to not engage with it. Maybe he's going to start talking about it in 10 years from now. I don't know. He started talking about America First now, and America First was a thing 10 years ago. So you can think maybe we still have 3 to 10 years to wait before Brett consults this theory, which directly addresses many of the questions he's had. Brett has been out there in interviews saying we need this little tweak to mimetics. I've given that tweak. That tweak is in the revolutionary phenotype, Brett. So mimetics is resolved. It's false. And that is proven in TRP. There's also the fact that I haven't joined the Jewish religion yet. Maybe that could help, or maybe wear blackface. Maybe I could be part of some diversity initiative guest on his podcast. Hopefully at some point, Brett faces the knowledge in the theory of phenotypic revolution before he dies. Sean B. says, do you think we will have to make lots of babies to fight the AI fake people? Imagine all the unprotected sex we will have to help repopulate the earth. Well, yes, there's going to be a resistance. End of the line, Joel says, me mom died in the phenotype. Me mom died in the phenotype. Me dad got integrated into a virtual matrix for being used as a battery by the new revolutionary phenotype. That is it for today. So good night to everyone. Have fun. Reread your revolutionary phenotype, because that is a book that gains to be reread, and that is worth rereading. And I hope we can bring this book at the forefront of the public conversation before it's too late and before I die, really. It's like, I did produce a theory that is very important for humanity. Unfortunately, it's an advance on its time, but isn't that a fortunate thing in the end? And let us use this time where I'm still alive to discuss this. Classic Reader says, is 100 enough? I'm not talking about myself. 100 what? What are you talking about? All right. Much love, everyone. Sleep well. And I'll see you all tomorrow.